Time to go out in the garden, maybe bring the brolly. John Carey is here. He is the co-owner and horticulturalist at Sullis Eco Garden Centre in Port Arlington. Welcome to the Sweatbox.
Thanks very much, Will. Good to be here.
So, first off, we've had, until a few minutes ago, a very dry spell, very hot weather, and I'm sure there are many plants you'd be concerned about in conditions like that.
Correct, but as you see, things can change very fast in gardening. Certainly with our weather that we get here, as I was walking to the studio, the rain just started bucketing down, as you say, so things can change fast. But we have had a very prolonged dry spell, and as a result, we can see all our lawns are yellow. There's been a real stagnation of growth in the gardens, and that can be a welcome sign because it gives a gardener maybe a bit of a breathing space to actually sit back and enjoy the lovely weather. But if you are concerned about your the first thing we'd say is don't do any treatment. Don't be scarifying. Don't grass. Don't be feeding it or weeding it. Just the lawns are quite stressed out. So if you are out cutting the grass, you're going to further stress your lawn. So the ideal thing to do with your lawn in a drought period is to leave it be and wait for the rain, because, you know, it's never far away.
Yes, you're looking at somebody who took more last Saturday.
Oh,
because
right.
Pollinators loved it, but it did look like nobody lived there anymore.
Right, so it can look a bit neglected.
It did, it looked very neglected.
There was an urge there just to tidy things up a little.
Yeah, but the grass didn't like it.
But when you talk about pollinators, we have this new movement, you could call it, which is no mow May. Now we're past May, but you can apply that to any month of the growing season, really. And it's a great idea. It's for your pollinators, and it's basically you put the mower away for the entire month of May, and you let the lawn do its thing. You'll see all sorts of buttercups, you'll see daisies, you'll see dandelions even, all sprouting away. Even grass will set seed as well. And this is the perfect conditions for your pollinators. So something to consider for next year.
The grass should recover. We saw, I think it was 2018 was the summer of the long drought. It came back. It didn't take that long to turn green again. But is there anything that you would be particularly watching out for? If it doesn't get enough rain and enough moisture, enough to drink, it's going to die.
Other than lawns. Well, of course, yeah. Like anything that's in a container, you have to keep a very close eye on your potted plants throughout this period. Every second day, every garden, every site is a little bit different. So I can't say it's set. You have to water every second day. But within reason, you want to check over all your potted plants every second day and give them a good watering. And when you're watering, ideally you want to water early in the morning. Avoid watering in the heat of the sun. Water on the foliage and the sunlight will burn foliage, so you want to avoid that. And when you're watering, ideally give each plant a small drop of water. Let that drain down into the soil. You want to imagine the water going down about 8 inches into the soil, and then apply another splash of water on it again, rather than all the water at once, because when you apply all the water at once, it can just rush off the edge of your plants and you're wasting water. So,
are we done with the chores now, or is there more?
No, that's it for chores. It's all or not, sit back and relax.
Okay. I like that prescription. Now, from Tommy, who has a veg patch and he suspects weevil is in there somewhere. Weevil eating everything with a green leaf. He wants to spray something natural, because obviously it's a veg patch and he wants to gobble it up himself at some stage.
Yeah, so you want to keep it organic, you want to keep it natural, you want to avoid pesticides, even if you're not eating it these days. We're all very much against pesticides. So if you're talking about a vine weevil, a pretty problematic pest in gardens, and there is a solution, there is an organic solution, and it's called Super Nemos. So this is available, we actually sell in our garden centre, which is in Port Arlington. And it's simply a microscopic worm, a nematode. So you buy a packet of worms, effectively, and you dilute that in water. And then with a watering can, then you apply that diluted mix over the surface of your vegetable patch. Those microscopic worms will work their way down into the soil, and they will begin the battle with your nematodes, and they will hopefully win that battle and reduce the pest. So it is a biological, natural, safe solution for many soil-borne pests in the garden, and it's called Super Nemos. It's really good.
sounds like a Transformers script or
it's
something.
It's a little bit like
Super Nemos battling the nematodes.
Yeah, that's what it, and like that's kind of what pests are. If a pest is an insect in the garden that is maybe its numbers have gotten so large that it's attacking all of your crops. So what we do in biological pest control is we try to re-establish a balance in nature between the pests and the good guys and the bad guys, you could say.
Yes. Text here from Mary, by the way. Yep. Mary says, don't forget to put on your sunblock. Wow. She sent us a picture of...
pushing down out
there. Oh, it's a very wet image. Thanks, Mary. Now, next from Joe. Spray for potatoes that is non-chemical. Is there such a thing?
Well, with EU regulations now, we're losing all of our traditional blight control products. So there is one thing left on the market, really, because they've taken them all away. Pyroxenol has been removed last year. So we have a copper mixture now, and that is relatively effective. It's natural, of course, copper mixture. So it's relatively effective, but you need regular applications of it. And that is a method of controlling blight on your potatoes.
Define regular.
Weekly applications, you know. Now, and right now, before this rain patch, I was going to say we're okay. Blight is more of an issue in damp conditions, right? So half an hour ago, I said you don't need to worry about blight. But now we need to once again be vigilant for blight. So now is the time for applying your copper mixture right away.
John Carey is here from the Sullis Eco Garden Centre in Port Arlington. And the next question comes from Doreen, who happens to be in Port Arlington. And she's wondering, what is the cheapest hedging that you can buy, one that grows quickly and gives plenty of privacy?
Oh, so, yeah, so...
ticks lots of boxes there,
yeah,
cheap
no,
and great.
This is a question that you would get fairly often, and it's a fair question. You know, people want instant privacy and hedging, you know, you're always going to need a lot of it, so you want to get it at the right price. And that is why we cleverly have bare root plants. And bare root plants are plants that are not in a pot, their roots are exposed, and they work out way better value because you're getting a bundle of plants together in almost a handful of plants. You could get 10 or 15 in your hand. That makes them easier to transport, ship and sell, so they're cheaper. Now, the only problem with bare root plants is you can only buy them and plant them in the dormant season, and that is from September through to April. So that's what I would suggest. Obviously, if you're going to go for hedging, it's a bare root hedge you want to grow. And the best plants to do would be either beech, copper beech or green beech, which is a beautiful non-native, but it's indigenous in Ireland. So it's almost native. It's all over Ireland. It's all over woodlands and whatnot. It has lovely soft green leaves. It is semi-deciduous, which means the leaves go brown in winter, but they don't fall off the plant. Okay, so in summer you have a beautiful...
And mine do.
Is this making sense? They fall... On a large tree, the leaves fall off, but on a beech hedgerow, they shouldn't. Are they falling off of you?
I kind of let mine grow quite a bit.
Yeah, let it get a bit... How tall is quite a bit?
20 feet or more.
Okay, yeah. See, they only have the ability to hold the foliage on, I think, the lower half of the plant. Mm. So if you see in the wild a big specimen mature beech, all the top in winter, all the top, no foliage, and then at the bottom it'll retain some of its foliage. So it's called semi-evergreen, or semi-deciduous. So that's an option. Your second option, if you want to go pure native, would be whitethorn, because it's really good for our plants. It's good, for our birds, for our bees. It flowers beautifully in May. It has berries in autumn. It has thorns if you want a bit of security along with your privacy.
Fast growing too.
Oh, sorry, fast growing. Key to all, fast growing. So that's another good recommendation. It's either beech or whitethorn.
Okay, Doreen, hope they are useful to you. Lucas has two cucumber plants. One of them gives a nice crop, the other not really. Maybe two cucumbers on it, but plenty of flowers, and then some of them die. So he's wondering what's wrong with his...
Sicker of the two. Can happen, you know, sometimes plants just don't perform. If they're in the exact same environment, you would wonder why one and not the other. But there could be a case where the larger could be shading the smaller plant. So something to consider in terms of the aspect of your greenhouse and where you've positioned it. Are they in the soil or are they in pots? The second pot could be drying out faster. There could be sunlight hitting the pot itself, and sunlight hitting the side of a black plant pot dries out super fast. So that could be your other issue. Recommendation for now is keep an eye on watering. If it is in a pot, maybe reposition it to the other side of the larger cucumber. And then the third suggestion, if it's in flowering now, this is the time to start a potassium-based feed. Potassium encourages flowering, which encourages fruiting. So that's what we would do. Start your tomato or your potassium-based feed.
Nancy says, send on that rain to Burr. I'll stand out in it. I'm absolutely fed up of the hot sunshine. Okay, well, it's gone from here, Nancy, so it might be on its way to you. J.R. in Kilbeggan says he's heard some rumblings. Is there thunder about? I would say probably. Okay, from Dave. Will they say to leave your lawn to grow, allow the buttercups to spread for the bees? And I agree with all of that, but there comes a point when it needs to be cut before it turns into a meadow. When will somebody please, please, please teach the bees
okay,
that a big red, green, noisy thing heading your way is seriously bad news? Somebody needs to teach bees what a lawnmower looks and sounds like.
We're getting on to that, yeah.
Yes, thanks, Dave. They will evolve. They will evolve indeed. Now, next. Someone or something is eating just one of the tomato plants in my tunnel. My fine big tomatoes are being gobbled up. I have a door mesh to stop birds going in. But something is attacking this one plant, says Anne in Tullamore.
Okay, Anne, it could be a worm, like a fruit worm attacking your plant. So again, Super Nemos, again, is a solution on this because it's your worms, which will be soil-borne, are easily controlled with Super Nemos. So if you're familiar with it, it's a simple product we talked about earlier in the show. It's something that you dilute in water and then just using a watering can, just apply it around the surface area of your tomato and let it do its work. So that should be a solution there.
All right. Next caller wonders, when is the best time to cut back a cherry tree?
So cherries are going to flower on their current season's growth. So there's two times really. They're going to flower and fruit in. They're going to flower in summer, and then if it's a fruiting cherry, it's going to fruit in autumn. Mm. So that is the time at which you would cut it back straight after fruiting. That's if it's a fruiting cherry. If it's a flowering cherry, you cut it back in early spring, so probably early February.
Ah, right. So if it's cherry blossom, for instance, and they usually come out late April,
they do,
early May.
Mid-April through to the end of April, start of May. 2 weeks is probably all you're going to get out of a flowering cherry.
And they're lovely.
They're so lovely, but they ring in spring, they ring in summer. So that's why we love them so much, you know, and they really lighten the soul when they come into flower.
But leave it for now and give it its chop back in February.
After fruiting, if it's a fruit-based cherry or if it's a flowering cherry, early February.
Okay, 083 30 10 103. Text and WhatsApp, we'll take one or two more. Will I have a patio that has turned pure green with moss? And I'm looking for a product, again, eco-friendly, that will attack the moss and have minimal elbow grease involved.
Yeah, there is a lot of products available now for that. There is a product on the market called I can't try to think of the name of it now, but there's so many out there really. Well, there's a brand by Neudorf. There's so many. I can't really think of
a million
brands.
Will come to you as soon
a
as
million
we're off
will
air.
Come.
Yeah.
Like, I think what's sticking in my head is how my mum to this day still uses washing up powder on her patio. And
lots of people do. Yeah.
Well, we don't know. I don't know what the research on this is, but is it affecting our soil below? I'm not too sure. But
also, I don't believe it's as economical as people believe it to be.
Yeah.
Some think it's the cheapest way of doing it, but not necessarily,
because the coverage you get off the ones you get in garden centres will cover such large areas. You get about 1,000 square metres coverage out of 1 litre. So you dilute it down, you apply it over the surface of your patio, you brush it in and hay press, so you have your solution for 1 year because it just keeps coming back.
Will that work on decking?
It will work on some deckings, so it depends on what product you go with. There are specific decking cleaners out there. I think Jay's Fluid have their own brand of deck cleaner as well. So, but I think we're all kind of moving away from the wooden deck. There's a lot of maintenance in them. If you're in a shaded area, they get damp, they get slippy, they rot very quick. A lot of people are now moving towards a more long-term solution, which is a composite deck, which is a plastic wood mix. So there are even eco-friendly versions now where they're using recycled plastic in their wood.
Very good.
And you're getting a lifetime of a deck, really, rather than a wooden one, which is treacherous, really, especially in Irish climate.
Will, there was a thunder shower just passing over Clara, so it's likely your listener in Kilbeggan heard that. We're turning into the weather channel here, so we are. But thanks, Paul, for the message. John, we're out of time.
Okay.
Great to have you in
thanks
studio. And thank you very much. You can find him at Sullis Eco Garden Centre in Port Arlington. We were talking earlier about when your grass grows to such an extent it looks like nobody lives in your house anymore and you just have to go out and give it a mow, even if you're trying to protect the pollinators and you want all the buttercups and all of the daisies and all of the other things that attract them in. Aidan in Portlaoise has a suggestion, and he says if you just cut the grass around the outermost perimeter, well, it's clear to everybody that somebody still lives there and you're leaving the centre of it for the bees. Is that a solution you can go for? I'm just wondering, Aidan, does it not look then like you started cutting the grass, you fell asleep, you went in to watch the telly, you just couldn't be bothered finishing it? Would it not visually still look a bit strange? Anyway, it depends on why you're doing it and what your motivations are. Now, still to come today, we look at the not alone the Irish film sector, as we were talking about earlier, but also the areas of the country that are most at risk of drought. And there's one particular part of County Laois that Irish Water is concerned for, and you'll hear from its regional operations manager a little later. Now, the main story on the morning papers concerns the rather surprise decision yesterday by government ministers to restrict movement into Ireland, visa-free movement into Ireland by people from 20 European countries. And let's explore why these immigration rules are being tightened given the backdrop of Ukraine, but also some other factors. Gabia Gatvakeja is a political reporter with the Irish Independent. Gabia, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I understand European countries have very seldom taken this step. You have to go back to the early noughties when the UK did it and back to 1986 for France. So why have we taken the step now?
Yes, so it's called the Council of Europe Agreement. And basically what it means is that every country that's signatory to the agreement, if a person is granted refugee status in one of those countries, they can, I suppose, freely move to another signatory country without a visa for a period of up to 3 months. Now, cabinet ministers met incorporeally yesterday, which means that they met virtually, to temporarily suspend Ireland's participation in the. So if a refugee status in the following countries, it's Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Germany, a whole host of countries, 20 countries, if they come to Ireland for up to 3 months, they will need to go through a visa process as opposed to just travelling here visa-free. Now, you're asking why that decision was taken. So government is concerned that there has been, I suppose, an exploitation and abuse of the system a little bit, where people would be granted refugee status in those countries, but then they would be coming to Ireland and they would be applying for refugee status again. So, for example, from January 2021 to January 2022, there were 760 refugees applied for a refugee status in Ireland after having already been granted in another country. But over half of those refugees were granted refugee status from one of those EU member states that have those visa exemptions. So, of course, we're seeing, you know, tens of thousands of Ukrainians come here. We know that we're facing serious issues in accommodating those people, not just with housing, but literally taking them in and accommodating them. And I suppose government officials are just, and ministers are really concerned that, you know, we try and protect our international protection system. And that's what Justice Minister Helen McEntee said, that there's evidence that the system might be abused and you know, this decision was not taken lightly, you know. But I suppose
Gabby, just for context, yeah, you mentioned a figure of 760 refugees having this double status for all of last year. Against that backdrop of Ukraine, and we're at, I think, 47,000 people having arrived from there, it's not a huge number to be affected by this move yesterday, is it?
No, it definitely isn't. I mean, if you're comparing it to 40,000, I mean, that's, of course, very little. So if you're looking at that figure, 479 refugees who were granted refugee status from one of those countries that have come here and applied for refugee status again, I mean, that's a very slim number. And that actually only makes up 7% of the total applications for international protection in that period, which was 6,494. So, I mean, that's a drop in the ocean compared to 40,000. So it is an interesting decision by government. I suppose probably ministers are thinking at a point where, you know, we're kind of, I suppose, clutching at straws trying to accommodate people. And that really, if there is such abuse, if there is this abuse of the system, as we're being told that there is, you know, that really just cannot be afforded at this moment.
Indeed, but it would seem that it's a very small number who are trying to pull off this abuse. Let's talk about the reaction. So the Irish Refugee Council, for instance, they have described the move as regressive. What's their concern?
Yes, so there have been concerns raised that, you know, it's a very sort of a rash, you know, move that, as you say, I mean, you're making very much the same points that you are, you know, saying that this is a bit of an extraordinary move for something that really affects quite a small number of people. Opposition spokespersons, including Jennifer Whitmore from the Social Democrats, you know, she's saying that, you know, we really haven't exhausted all of the options of accommodation that are available for refugees. So even if you look, for example, at Ukrainians, you know, she's making the argument that that pledged accommodation has not been fully utilised. We know that half of it fell through for reasons that are beyond the government's control. But that's half, you know, about 10,000 accommodation places that have not been utilised yet, that they're still lying there empty. You know, she's also making the argument that the modular housing that we heard about, that has not been put in place. So I suppose it's an interesting move by the government. It wasn't expected at all yesterday. The cabinet was not supposed to meet this week at all. The Taoiseach is currently on a trip to Japan, and so it had to meet virtually just to literally make this decision.
A few people have asked about Ukraine specifically, so we should clarify that anybody coming from Ukraine can still travel to Ireland visa-free.
Yes, that's right. So Ukraine is exempt from this decision. Of course, we know that earlier in the year when the war broke out, we moved to put in place, you know, we were sort of treating Ukraine as if it was an EU country. So, of course, if you're traveling from Ireland to another EU country, you're an Irish citizen, or you're an EU citizen, you don't need a visa, and that same applies to Ukraine. And Ukrainians won't be affected by this decision, essentially.
Gabby, appreciate your time. Thank you for walking us through it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Gabby Gatavacasia is a political reporter with the Irish Independent. So, with reports of people lying on the floor in City West, which is our quote-unquote welcoming centre for Ireland, the accommodation crisis is obviously meeting its limits. There aren't beds available for these people, even in City West. That's why they have a blanket, they have a duvet, they have a sleeping bag, and they are on the floor. So the challenge is, how can we be creative? What other means and options are available if we are to continue taking refugees from Ukraine and elsewhere? Well, let's look at what they're doing overseas. And that brings us to Tom Cleary in the Netherlands. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Will. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I believe you're having much the same challenge there with capacity reaching its limits. So what's the conversation like?
Now, what's interesting in the Netherlands is very close to me, only 5 minutes away, is a town, and they're on the North Sea Canal. And they're bringing in a luxury cruiser to host 1,200 refugees in the on the ship for from the 1st of August until for 6 months. So that's what they're going to do. That's one of the things they're doing.
Well, a cruise liner should have ample facilities to provide for people in comfort, in quality. What's been the reaction to the idea?
Now, that's a good question. I was just going to answer that. The reaction is very negative because the town where they're going to moor the ship, I think they call that, is only 5,000 inhabitants. So that's 20% of the population will be then Europeans.
So that puts pressure on doctors, on schools, on all of the other services in the area.
Yeah. There've been marches, but it's going ahead from the 1st of August. It's going ahead.
And are the other facilities at their limits in the Netherlands?
Yes, all very much. You have four camps in the Netherlands where refugees are put in place. And in one of them, it's called Den Apel. The last couple of nights, because of overcrowding, they've been sleeping outside. And like for a country like the Netherlands, there's uproar, of course, that should not be allowed in 2022. That place, people are sleeping outside because there's no room for them. I think there was almost 300 refugees sleeping outside.
Well, you may have heard the previous conversation. The Irish government decided yesterday to restrict visa-free movement for refugees from a whole host of countries, including the Netherlands, by the way. Has there been any talk of strengthening immigration rules where you are?
It's 50-50, I think, the same as in Ireland. Like 50% want refugees to get a house or a place to stay. But also the other 50% is that we're full. And I think that's the big thing. Where's the limit? And I think Denmark is the place where they have a limit. And when that limit is reached, no other refugees come in. Just send them away. So I don't know what's going to happen. Like all the it's always been used the for politics. It's always a nice way to get in the picture where you're campaigning or whatever. But at the end of the day, nothing much is really happening.
All right. I appreciate your time as always, Tom. It's interesting to hear what ideas are being promoted in other countries. A cruise liner, I can only imagine trying to tow one up the Shannon and trying to pitch it in Banagher. I don't think that would go down too well, would it?
And Banagher is the place to be this weekend with that beach Banagher, and the weekend after with the Banagher, the beach on the street. So that's two weekends where being in Banagher is really interesting.
Tom, you've got your plug in. Thanks for your time.
You
we'll talk soon.
Bye bye.
Tom Cleary, who, by the way, is originally from Banagher, living in the Netherlands, has done so for a long time. Now, 083 3010 103 on text and WhatsApp. Will a lot of people mow their grass at the outer edge and leave a path around the perimeter for wildflowers to grow in the middle? And it looks well, I think. That's from Nuala. So, yes, Aidan, our previous caller from Portlaoise, your idea seems to be catching on. And let's see if we can promote it, because, again, we're only here for a short time on this planet, and the less damage we can do, the better. And if we don't have pollinators, well, we don't have a future, do we? What's the weather like where you are? Apart from being very, very hot, have you had a good downpour of rain? Because a lot of listeners are craving it. Certainly the plants are. Temperature in Mullingar at the moment, 19 degrees. So a good bit cooler than yesterday, thank heavens. And speaking of Mullingar, the organisers of Fla Ceoil na hÉireann are coming into the final straight for this year's event. Which will cost 1.7 million euro to stage, and of course is the homecoming of the FLA. The festival's organising body, COLTAS, was founded in Mullingar in 1951. Midlands 103's Robert Kindrigan has been looking back over the history of the festival.
I cannot still trying to sing you a verse not to let you all know how the flag here got on. And for you now who couldn't attend these, they came from the north and they came from the east. From the west and the south was a thriller to see, with fiddles and bagpipes and piccolos too, and drumsticks to keep them in order. They came down from Dublin, so happy and gay. They brought Leo Rawson to show them the way.
The Fláchiúil is one of Ireland's largest festivals. It's a cultural celebration of traditional Irish music and can have up to 500,000 visitors take to its host town every year. Despite its current popularity, Ciúltas Ciúltóirí Éireann was founded in 1951 to promote the struggling art form. Their first plan of action was to organise a competitive music event in Mullingar, says Jackie Iquina from Ciúltas Salthill, Knocknacara.
When we see how strong it is today, believe it or not, back in the 1950s, certainly 40s and 30s, traditional music was not popular. It was considered that old diddly eye stuff and it was old fashioned and it was old hat, and musicians would find it very, very hard to find a place to play. Pubs would chase them out if you started playing, or if you started singing you'd be barred. And it was hard for people who had kept that tradition going and had inherited instruments and inherited the love of playing and music to find a place to play together and to learn from each other and learn tunes from each other. So in 1951, a group of Illan pipers, actually in an organization called the Pipers Club in Dublin, they were sort of trying to reach out to other musicians, and they made contact with a group of people in Mullingar in County Westmeath, and they decided that they needed to set up an organization that would allow them all to meet together, to train and teach young people the music, but also to find an opportunity for them to play with each other and compete against each other. So those are the two ambitions. And as a result, Ciúltas Ciúltóirí Éireann was founded in 1951 in Mullingar. And people, I suppose, who had been almost embarrassed to take out their instruments and play, found it suddenly acceptable. They found their tribe, so to speak. It just grew legs and it took off in a way that I think even they didn't imagine, to the point that we have literally hundreds of branches, over 400 branches throughout the world at this stage of Ciúltas Ciúltóirí Éireann. Literally, I'd say the number of people who come through their hands is in the millions at this stage, either learning music, you know, instruments or teaching. It's an extraordinary success story.
The first Fláchiúil attracted only a few hundred people at its inception in 1951. But it returned to Mullingar in 1963 as one of the most significant weekends in the history of the state, according to Liam Collins, news editor of the Irish Independent.
A reporter I was talking to one day, we were at something, and you talk about festivals and occasions. I think the question was, where did sex become a public thing in Ireland? And I was telling him, you know, listening to Varna and festivals I'd attended when I was younger. And he said, no, it was the Fláchiúil in Mullingar in 1963. And it kind of just triggered a memory for me of my father driving, inching through the street. This was totally unexpected. It was incredible spectacle when I recalled it. You know, that's how I came to the story of what the poet John Montagu called the Siege of Mullingar.
The Siege of Mullingar. The Fláchiúil in Mullingar, there were two sons, the breaking of glass and the background pulse of music. Young girls roamed the streets with eager faces, pushing for men. Bottles in hand, they rode out a song. Puritan Ireland's dead and gone.
What was unleashed in Mullingar that weekend caused outrage around the country. The resignation of a senior flower organiser and a statement from the Bishop of Meath in the Westmeath Examiner showed resistance to a more awakened Ireland. One cannot ignore the fact that many young men and women chose to make this festival an occasion of sinful conduct, giving great scandal to decent people in the town, said the Bishop.
The streets were blocked and there was people lying on the sidewalks or on the paths, having drinks, and it was probably the early afternoon. And the Westmeath Examiner wasn't much given to outrage, but they were certainly outraged by the events that weekend. The Pope was a national figure in those days, and for a long time afterwards, much more so than it would be today. The background also was that the Pope John the 23rd was dying in Rome at the time. So it was this kind of juxtaposition of the very old religion you know, and this new breed of music and entertainment and people gathering for all the things that go with a festival. So I think that's what made it such an important moment for a poet like Montagu.
Although times have changed and the FLA has become modernised, there is still much resemblance to the days of old. This can be seen particularly with sleeping arrangements. Fiddle competitor Jack Kennedy recalls travelling to his first competition at the Tullamore FLA as recently as 2009, where he slept in a mattress in the back of a van.
I was playing under 12 fiddle. The FLA was in Tullamore. Me and my father went to it and we actually borrowed my granddad's Jeep. We put a mattress in the back of it. It's one of those Jeeps that only has the seats in the front. Put a mattress in the back of it and we went up for the weekend, Friday to Sunday, and we stayed for the festival. It was a great crack.
Sleeping arrangements for a huge influx of festival goers in the hundreds of thousands can put strain on typically small host towns. But the economic impact on local businesses is huge, according to Drogheda hotel owner and president of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, Mark McGowan, who was able to buy a pub following the success of Drogheda's FLA Ceoil in 2018.
We have a big car park in front of the hotel and we decided to set up our own concept. We called it the FLA Village and we put food trucks, we put a stage, tiered seating, so we could get approximately 2,000 people into our car park. And it's a relatively small hotel, so we have a 16-bedroom hotel with a bar that would normally seat about 40 and a restaurant that would seat about 100. This was huge numbers for us that we weren't used to. We definitely threw all our eggs into one basket and said we're going to try and make the most of this. Luckily for us, it prevailed and we ended up managing to buy a pub right beside the hotel for the following year, knowing that it was going to be so good again. It was a huge success for us. In terms of revenues, to put a percentage on it, I'm going to say about a 600% increase in comparison, and that's purely because of the size of my venue in comparison to the size of my car park. I don't think we would have been in the position to purchase that pub outright unless we had the first FLA Ceoil. Our business is open 20 years, or 18 years. It was a real pivotal moment for us when the first FLA Ceoil came.
From a music perspective, UCD lecturer in ethnomusicology, Therese Smith, believes festivals such as the FLA Ceoil na Éireann is important for setting a certain standard in the genre.
I think they're very important, and they're important for two reasons. One, they promote a particular standard of performance, which is great, but they also engage people. So in an informal sense, the formal competitions are very important, but in the informal engagement of music are equally as important. And I think for traditional music, the two have to go hand in hand. I mean, the competitions, which is the sort of the focus of the FLA na in many ways, are to uphold a certain standard in the tradition.
This view is mirrored by fiddle competitor Jack Kennedy.
It was kind of like a standard. It's to show how good you are. So if you show up every year and you can play, you play two tunes in competitions, you might play three in under 15 as well. But like, if you can show up every year and play those two or three tunes to a very good level, it brings the rest of your music up a certain amount as well. So it's just kind of showing up every year and showing that you're making progress every year. It's a good way of practicing, you know.
The FLA Ceoil na Éireann is set to return to its roots this August as Mullingar welcomed it home for the first time since that weekend in 1963. Whether the so-called unruly scenes will be repeated remains to be seen. One thing for sure is the town will experience huge economic benefits and play host to some fantastic music. It'll be an ambitious spectacle celebrating the cultural wealth we boast in the form of traditional Irish music.
And that report by Midlands 103's Robert Kindrigan. Can't wait for the FLA. 500,000 people in Mullingar is going to be incredible. And Midlands 103 will be there every single day, bringing you lots of coverage, lots of sound bites, lots of faces and sessions. And Paddy Duffy, of course, every Sunday for the last 30 years has presented Coppers and Brass, a cultist programme here on Midlands 103, Sunday evenings between 6 and 8. And already we're seeing overseas interest, Midlands103.com, the live stream of the radio station that goes out to 70-odd countries, what is it, every single week. And the number of overseas listeners steadily increasing throughout July, as it did over a decade ago when the FLA was in Tullamore as well. Now on text 083 3010 103, Will, it's a pity the politicians and the do-gooders don't put as much effort into looking after their own people as they do on the refugee issue. If so, we wouldn't have had a housing crisis for the last decade. That's from Marie in Portlaoise. And in case you're just joining us, there has been a tightening of the visa rules for refugees travelling from 20 European countries, including Belgium, the Czech Republic, Denmark, the Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, Spain is in there, and even non-EU countries such as Switzerland. So we will see what effect that has over the next 12 months. It will be reviewed in a year's time. And according to the Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, there is evidence the system may have been abused by people who have claimed refugee status in one European country and subsequently come here to claim it again. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Simon Coveney, said the decision will actually help protect Ukrainians. He says it will assist in the protection of Ukrainians and those of other nationalities who are fleeing conflict, as it will lessen the incidence of abuse in the system. It is not unprecedented. Other European countries have taken similar action previously. He's referring there to the UK in the early noughties and to France in 1986. Now, let's finish the programme by looking skywards, and while there has been some rain today, it's been fairly dry of late, and even the long-range forecast over the next 10 days doesn't show significant falls of rain. And so Irish Water is concerned about some risk of drought, in particular at the Swan in County Laois. But let's take a regional view with Operations Manager John O'Donoghue. John, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
So you've talked on this programme before about groundwater supplies, and there can be a bit of a lag there. Will you give us an explanation as to why in a wet country like this we can have problems from time to time?
Yeah, Will, and thanks for the opportunity. I suppose first and foremost, you know, we like to thank the public. We do get great cooperation in terms of water conservation, and we do encourage it sort of right the way through the year. But certainly in the current climate, we have very dry weather, as you said, and has been particularly dry in the last number of days. And, you know, the soil itself is very dry, and it takes a while for boreholes to recover. So that obviously the levels do drop at certain times during the summer, and it puts supplies at risk. And we are seeing a lot of this happening, you know, within the region itself and nationally as well, right around the country. We've some 17 schemes at the moment where we're either have restrictions or we're tankering or a combination of all of these. And what we're asking to do really is for the public to conserve where possible. I mean, there are situations where we, you know, where people have to use water. Obviously, it must be used, but we would ask that they look at it in terms of even simple things like paddling pools or reusing the water afterwards, simple things like not using, I suppose, hoses, garden hose, or washing the car if you have to do it with a sponge and a bucket, really. And even simple tips like brushing of teeth or fixing dripping taps or even external leaks where you ring our number on 1800 278 278, and the leak can be fixed free of charge under our First Fix Free scheme. So there's a lot that we can do and work together collaboratively, I suppose, to get us through the summer months, July and August, you know. So that's what we're appealing to the public generally to, I suppose, think about the usage in the home, in the garden as well, and reuse where possible any water that you use, and, you know, simple things like watering the garden at night time when it doesn't evaporate, and things like that, and use of water butts and general sort of conservation tips that we use. And we do have a calculator as well, which we use. It's on our website, water.ie/calculator, which gives very useful tips on how to conserve water in the home. So it's a general appeal to the public to conserve water right throughout summer months and right throughout the year, really. And it does help us tremendously.
John, that's the overview that in general. Let's look at some areas of particular concern. Can you look across these Midland counties and tell us where is under the most pressure?
Yeah, I suppose, as I say, you mentioned the Swan there already. We did have issues there with boreholes, and we are tankering there at the moment. Specifically, while the levels are dropping in the likes of Mullingar, the supply is still reasonably stable. It's just above the average for the last 5 years in terms of Lough Ool itself, but obviously demand is quite high. Other than that, I suppose we're looking more at the likes of Limerick and Wexford Town, Buncloddy. There are major challenges there. Also, the likes of Tipperary and obviously down in West Cork as well. Cork itself, there's quite a few schemes there that are under pressure at the moment, and tankering and nighttime restrictions. Again, the places like Donegal, West Galway as well, and parts of Limerick and Waterford. So it's generally around the country, but I suppose the biggest impact is probably the southern side of the country, really, where we have a lot of restrictions and tankering going on at the moment. And overall, we have 17 schemes that are in drought status at the moment, and that number is probably changing on a daily basis.
I know this question always comes up, but it's a bugbear for listeners. How much is lost by leaks at the moment? And I know you've been working in Irish Water to try and bring down the figure over recent years.
Yeah, we have. I suppose we started off at a very high figure of maybe up around the high 40s, 46% 2018. But, you know, we've put a lot of investment into it. We're spending quite a lot of money, or 200, 250 million a year on leakage. We're down to sort of 38, is what we're down to now, which is a big improvement. We keep going. Obviously, we want to get down to the 20s, but that's a very much a long-term plan. But what you do have to bear in mind, Will, is that the age of the network is quite old. It's kind of twice the European average in terms of, I suppose, lack of investment over many, many years. So that's combined with the amount of network we have as well. Like, we've 63,000 kilometres of network right around the country, which is a lot. And we are working, I suppose, we have to strike a balance as well, working to reduce leakage. But I suppose we have to do our bit on the leakage side, which I suppose we can help as well with the public in terms of conserving water. Because, you know, even if it rains and you get water, there's still only a certain amount of water you can actually produce with the capacity we have in our plants. And we're expanding that all the time. So it is very much a collaborative effort. And we do get fantastic support from the public. And all we're asking to do is just to continue that support now and be particularly mindful in July and August, especially in terms of conservation.
Well, you've given us some of the tips already, and indeed we've a list here from Irish Water, which we will publish on midlands103.com. Anybody who wants to cut back as much as they can. The weather forecast doesn't suggest a huge change in the short term. So how much rain do you need? How long of a continuous downpour is required to restore supplies to a point where you're no longer concerned?
Well, I suppose, to be fair, what we call the soil moisture deficit, and Metairn would publish this. Sometimes you see it on the forecast, but a lot of it is showing red at the moment, where you've 50 or 60, maybe 70 millimetres of rain that you actually need to absorb the ground before you get any benefit in terms of runoff. So soil moisture deficit is what they call it. So you probably would need an average of 60 to 70 millimetres of rain, which is up to 3 inches of rain. Before you get an appreciable improvement, you know, that's a lot of rain, obviously. While we do get rainfall over a short, especially in the summertime, short bursts of rain don't do a lot of good for us, really. You need more continuous rain for us to get the benefit in terms of our raw water supplies, you know. So that just gives you an idea of what we need at the moment.
John, grateful for your time. Thanks for taking the call.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
John O'Donoghue is the Regional Operations Manager with Irish Water. Will, why do we not get told about the hikes in prices in so many supermarkets? They're always pitching it as if they're giving great value. Well, Dunn's, 3 litres of milk, €2.90. That's the second hike in less than a year. It was €2 12 months ago, now €2.90. Food price inflation, that is going to be severe. We've had energy price inflation, 30% in some cases, food will follow, unfortunately. That's going to put severe pressure on a lot of people. But that's a conversation for another day. Pete Casey is coming next with the afternoon show. He shall be flying high with thanks to the Burr Air display, which is back, thank heavens. Hasn't been a Burr Air show since 2019. COVID put paid to it in 2020 and 2021. Well, he will be giving you some sought-after passes on the way in a few minutes. And a final message, a special hello to Geraldine Burns and Graham from Bracknah, who are off to Westport, and they're hoping for fine weather. And that's from all the crew in Burr. Talk to you tomorrow morning from 9. Bye-bye.